This is WS2N for the Limewalk TechNet, which meets here every Sunday at this time, 8 o'clock, for discussions dealing with technical topics. And that's the main part of the net. And then toward the very end of the net, we usually have the SpaceNet report. But tonight and last week, Roy, who normally does this net, AC2GS, is away for the holidays, and he'll be back next week. So we're just filling in. The name here is Paul, and the call is WS2N. We just drop it. Okay, and Roy usually reads off some websites and information that's very good for people listening to the net. The website usually to go to Roy's website. I don't think he has anything posted right now, but anything for the last couple of years posted on his website, and that's roy.ac2gs.com. And then there's the chat room, which this week is open, so you could always go to that. And sometimes it's busy, sometimes it's not. And that's chat.ac2gs.com. I checked in, but now I'm going to start doing the net. Probably won't be able to look at that. There's another one. You could listen to this net if you have trouble receiving it. You could listen to it on your computer. You go to technet.ac2gs.com. You can get this link on that computer as well. So there you go. I wonder if there's any early check-ins for tonight's Limewalk TechNet. This is WS2N. Name here is Paul.
Yay, 82.
Okay. We got OGB. Very good. Anybody else? 82FI. 2FI, very good. Checking in. And anybody else, with or without questions? You know, if it's a technical question, we have enough people on here. Somebody, I'm not Roy, that's for sure. But if you have a space question, I'm more than willing to discuss that. Any other check-ins?
KD2VHD.
VHD. Very good, Jim, right? And thank you for checking in. Anybody else? That's okay. Well, I don't have any technical questions or comments from my end. Like I said, I can always discuss what's going on in the space world. And if anybody has had the news on today, the first topic I was going to cover, which is the OSIRIS-REx sample return mission. Of course, that's probably going to be in the papers tomorrow. It's definitely on mainstream news, and I'll definitely go over that at this time. There's a place out in Utah called the Dugway Utah Proving Ground. It's the Army Proving Ground. They've been out there for forever, and it's a massive area. Probably the size of Rhode Island from what I heard on TV today. But it's roughly 30 miles long and, some 6 to 10 miles wide. And very flat. It's a desert. And that's the place they chose to land the sample return mission that came back from solar system. OSIRIS-REx was a mission that launched 7 years ago. From California. It was launched on an Atlas V rocket, and went under the configuration 411. 411 is the diameter. The 4 stands for the diameter of the fairing, which is 4 meters. That's at the top of the Atlas rocket. And then the 11, one of the 1 stands for the second stage, just has one rocket on the second stage. It's a Centaur liquid hydrogen, liquid helium rocket. And then there's another one in this case, and that stands for a booster. Out of this, five could run on as many as five boosters, depending on the load that it's taking up. For instance, the James Webb Space Telescope went up with five boosters. This one wasn't as heavy, and all they needed to do was get it into heliocentric orbit. So they just put one solid booster on it. And I remember covering that on this TechNet, and I'd like to talk about this particular mission, K2RIW, as well as Roy, when it did launch, because it was going out to an asteroid, Bennu. Bennu is around, I guess, around 1,500 feet in diameter. And Bennu is not a regular asteroid in the asteroid belt. It's a NEO, or near-Earth orbital asteroid, which comes near Earth every now and then. So they wanted to investigate this, they sent this OSIRIS-REx out to do exactly that. And OSIRIS-REx stood for Origin Spectral Interpretation Resource Identification Security Regolith Explorer. And it covered all of those names. Origins was, it wants to look into the first rocks in the solar system. And it's going to be like almost 5 billion years old is what they're thinking, 4.5 billion years old. And then the resource identification, they plan on seeing what's on this asteroid. In the future, there's going to be other asteroids like that. Could you use some of these resources, you know, for building something else out in space? They wanted to know what the asteroid is made of. And then security and Regolith Explorer. Well, security is, it comes under the idea that maybe this thing is going to come flying past Earth someday, and they do predict that around 130 years from now. It's going to get relatively close, but you know, suppose it, you know, they were off and it was really coming close. By that time, they would like to be able to nudge it out of the way, maybe push it ahead of the Earth or behind the Earth, and, you know, not directly into the Earth. And that comes under security. And then the Regolith Explorer, well, today confirmed that part of the name of OSIRIS-REx. It actually brought regolith or rocks back from Bennu. Like I said, it launched 7 years ago, 2016, and went out a couple of years to get to Bennu, and went into orbit around Bennu for about 2 years, and did all kinds of investigation. Had all kinds of close-up cameras, spectrometers, and it, you know, the standard equipment that NASA would put on one of these things. And it spent 2 years going in and out, getting closer each time to the asteroid. And they found out, you know, it was a lot of rocks. They thought it was going to be a flat thing before they got there, but it had rocks all over. I mean, just pebbles and rocks. What they wanted to do is bring back some material. So they had a seven-foot long arm sticking out of it. It was called the TAG, T-A-G, stood for touch and go. And I remember talking about this on the net, discussed how it worked. Anyway, it's a disc around 9 or 10 inches in diameter. It goes down to the surface on the end of an arm, and it, you know, at the right time, it blows a nitrogen charge through the circumference of this thing, and then by doing that, it's activating the material on the surface, and that gets blown into this one area, and then of the TAG unit, they trap it, and then they use the arm eventually and put that material inside this descent vehicle, part of OSIRIS-REx. So they know it locked up securely years ago. You know, they had all kinds of telemetry and pictures, and they knew that it was locked and sealed. So it just had to stay like that for a couple of years. After that, it left Bennu. By the way, when I went down to the surface, it has solar panels on the spacecraft. They even designed solar panels where they would actually fold back to some degree, so that, you know, if there was something on the side, you know, a little mountain or something sticking out, a little hill, you know, our panels weren't hit. And that all worked as well, too. So now it went back away from Bennu. That went back to the standard, linear design. So now this whole contraption eventually flew back to Earth. Here it is 2 years later, left Bennu, circled the Earth, and eventually came back to the southern part of California and entered the atmosphere over San Francisco. Built up a 5,000 degree temperature. So what happened was it got as close as 60,000 miles, which is one third or something the distance of the moon. And that's when the descent module separated from the OSIRIS-REx. Now it comes in toward the atmosphere and enters at 27,000 miles per hour, which is the fastest any of these any equipment that NASA has ever tried to return. Just like almost twice as fast as when something comes back from the International Space Station. And that comes back at 17,500. It's coming back at 27,000 miles an hour. So sure enough, it went well. Got through the atmosphere. The drogue shoots up and up around 400,000 feet. And that eventually pulls out the main. The main parachute wasn't supposed to open up until around 5,000 feet. Meanwhile, it opened up at 20,000 feet, four times higher. When I heard that, I said, I wonder what's going on there. But it turns out it's autonomous. So the sensors on board detected that it was going slow enough. It gets out to a certain speed. That's it, the parachute's come out. A deep parachute comes out. So it landed successfully this morning. Put it on NASA TV, had it on, and got to watch the cameras on board helicopters. You can see the parachute landed fine, and eventually had a crew go out there and poke around with it, make sure there was no fumes coming off it. And eventually the helicopter took it back to one particular location. They don't open up the canopy yet. It's just all sealed. And then from there, clean it up a little bit, but they're not going to open it up. And eventually they get a C-17 cargo vehicle. It's going to fly out of Utah and fly it to Texas, down near Houston. And they will, at that time, the scientists will get a hold of their, I guess, $4.5 billion rocks. It's roughly about a little over half a pound of stuff that they think is inside that capsule return system. So that's pretty good. A winner for NASA, and very well done. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N for the, I'm going to say the SpaceNet report, but it's really the TechNet report, kind of on the early side. Any comments? Okay, nothing hard. The area where this landed is, like I said, the Army Proving Grounds in Utah. And they've used it before. Two missions I know of landed equipment in this Utah desert. And one was called Stardust. And that went out to a comet, Billed 2, or it was spelled Wild, W-I-L-D, but Billed 2 was the comet that thing visited, and it had this aerojet catches that type of thing on it, and it went near the comet, and it was able to pick up some of the comet dust that comes off of a comet. And nobody used, that returned to Earth as well. I think it was launched the end of the millennium, 19, 1999, came back 6 years later and landed in this Utah desert as well. And I was successful. No problem with that. The only other one that they had a problem with was something called Genesis. Genesis was another mission that went out to space. It was only a couple of year long mission. And that had a gadget on board to try to get particles from the solar wind. You know, you have a mass corona ejection, and the scientists will examine what that is. So they did that, and they knew they had some very fine particles in this Genesis spacecraft, and that as well came back down eventually, again through heat shield parachute, and supposed to land in the Utah desert. But when it came time to open up the parachutes, didn't open up, and this thing kept coming down. You know, I mean, originally it's going 25,000 miles an hour, but it slows down with the heat shield, but not slow enough. It was still going like 250 miles per hour by the time it hit the ground. Genesis actually cracked open to some degree. Anyway, the scientists originally thought, well, it was a total loss, but they managed to save it anyway and got some of these particles, probably microscopic, I guess, out of this unit. But what they had found went wrong was, you know, the parachutes were supposed to deploy at a certain height. It knows to deploy it when it slows down at a certain speed. So on board the spacecraft, all three of them, Stardust, Osiris-Rex, and this one, Genesis, they all have little accelerometers on there. And the one that was on Genesis wanted to malfunction, because they got the unit back. So they figured out that the accelerometer was put in backwards. And I have seen pictures of it. Well, you know, it looks like a small diode, one of these diodes you would use for bridge rectifier system, maybe about an eighth of an inch in diameter. That's what it looked like, a little silver thing that wires sticking out of it. So apparently that was installed backwards. So when it came time to open up, it didn't do it, and that's what happened. Yeah. So I'm sure on this one they had it right, and there was no problem with the drogue chutes or the main parachute that opened up, and they have a big success on their hands, which is good, because in the future, another planned mission, although right now they're having financial problems, when I say they, NASA, due to a budget restraint, hopefully they can get that reversed. There's a sample return mission planned for some 40 vials coming back from Mars. Perseverance is in the process of collecting some vials, drilling holes, and they put them in these titanium tubes, and then they their goal is eventually to have these look like test tubes, we'll figure it out, of course, but eventually put onto a sample blast off from Mars, and eventually meet an orbital spacecraft going around Mars, which is supposed to be put up there by the European Space Agency, so to deal with them, and then turn that will deorbit Mars, and eventually do the same thing, come near Earth, and release its descent module, and that again will land in Utah. Now, one of the questions people had, during this mission, what's going to happen to the mothership? You know, you have this mothership, this good-sized vehicle, Osiris-Rex, that went out to Bennu, and it released the capital descent module. The main part of the Osiris-Rex is still functioning, so it has four engines on it. Lit the engines up before it got near Earth, 63,000 miles away from Earth when it released the capsule. So Osiris-Rex fired four engines and left Earth orbit well, not that it was going to go into orbit, but it got away from Earth, and again, it's now in a heliocentric orbit. It's going to move on to another asteroid. This time, it's going to Apophis. So they renamed the spacecraft from OSIRIS-REx to OSIRIS-APEX. I think I talked about that last week anyway. So that's the story. Any comments? Put in that. This is WS2N. Name here is Paul. Okay. Very good. Let me just go on and a couple of other interesting deep space missions that are coming up. One called Psyche. That's going to launch in October, beginning of October, October 5th, so about another week or two away. You're going to have the Psyche mission launch from Florida on a Falcon Heavy. They signed up with SpaceX for this one. NASA signed up with them a while back for them to do this job of sending this thing out to another asteroid called Psyche, also the same name as the mission. And so Falcon Heavy is the same thing as the Falcon 9, but then it has two more Falcon 9 attached to port side and starboard side. So it's like having three boosters in one. We'll launch from Florida, and then second stage, which is run by another Merlin engine, will 200,000 pounds of thrust will push Psyche all the way eventually to on its way to Psyche asteroid. That should be interesting. The spacecraft has huge solar panels. It's going to put out like 5,000 watts of energy. Has a nice telescope on board to receive infrared laser beams from Earth. Talked about that last week. Got an optical transmitter. It's going to be able to transmit infrared laser back to Earth. The idea is to be able to send 10 times the amount, at least maybe even 100 times more, depending on the on how it goes, more data than you can on RF. Right now, there's no plan on actually sending science data back from Psyche. This is just an experiment to see if this thing can do that. What happens is they send an infrared signal up to the spacecraft. The spacecraft's going to be able to pick that signal up, because that's being transmitted with it's got like a 5,000 watt transmitter on the ground, and it's going to transmit up to Psyche. That turn will transmit the data back down to Earth. Of course, you can only put out around 5 watts of optical power from the spacecraft, and if that works out, it'll be a success. I saw at a teleconference last week on this, one person said, "Do you have any capability of actually sending science data back?" So the principal investigators, they said, "Right now, no, we don't. We just want to see if this is doable. It's going to be like 1,000 times the distance of the moon. We've done it with the moon. They had one on an orbiter going around the moon that transmitted an optical back to Earth, which worked out quite well. This thing's going to be like 1,000 times further away. They just want to see if it's going to work." But yes, he says they do have the capability if they want to go beyond the time that they're supposed to be using this. They would try that, but they would have to get, I guess, funding or okay or whatever it is. But right now it's just a scientific experiment to see if you could send optical transmission from Psyche and an asteroid belt. Asteroid. Any comments? Okay. Okay, anyway, it's WS2N for the TechNet SpaceNet Report section. Anybody looking for Roy, Dr. Roy is out for the holidays. He will be back with us next week, so we'll have AC2GS back in our good graces here, hopefully next week, I'm sure. He doesn't miss any weeks. He's very good at this. There's another spacecraft actually on the way to Jupiter, another deep space mission called the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, or JUICE, which was launched by the European Space Agency 2 months ago, back in April. So that's been on its way to Jupiter. That was launched on an Ariane 5 rocket, one of the last few launches of the Ariane 5. They plan on upgrading to the Ariane 6 very soon. It's a little behind schedule. It should have launched by now. But hopefully Ariane 6 will be able to get off the ground either by the end of the year or maybe early next year to do all the heavy work. These are heavy lift vehicles, both Ariane 5 and Ariane 6. And that's what put JUICE into space. This thing it's got a cruise mission a little over 8 years before it gets to Jupiter. It's got one thing that's heavy. It weighs like 7 tons, like 14,000 pounds with fuel. I think it's like only about 5,000 pounds without fuel. That's usually the way it goes. It usually goes a little bit more than twice the amount. You know, if the spacecraft weighs 1,000 pounds, usually you can figure that with fuel and everything, it's usually 2,000 pounds. But that's a very heavy spacecraft that they launched. When it's out near Jupiter, it'll be producing only around 850 watts. So it's got a very big solar array. You know, I mean, near Earth it would be probably 4,000 or 5,000 watts, like a home generator. But out by Jupiter, it'll be around 850 watts. This is the inverse of square law, cuts back, and we'll see how that goes. The goal is to orbit Jupiter. It's gonna stay in orbit around Jupiter for a very long time. We've done that a couple of times now. I'd say NASA has done it a couple of times. We had Galileo orbiting Jupiter for quite a few years. And then even now we have Juno orbiting the polar orbit of Jupiter. And this thing will join it, looks like many years from now, but eventually it'll get there. It's going to approach relatively on the slow side. The idea is to try to get it into not only orbit around Jupiter, eventually slow enough where they could change the orbital inclination to it's almost a polar orbit. They could do that a little at a time. Every time they pass a moon or something, they could change the trajectory a little bit. Eventually, it will go from an elliptical orbit, an equatorial orbit, to a polar orbit. And once they do that, I think their final goal is to get it into orbit around Ganymede. Ganymede, is a moon bigger than our moon. It's one of the four Galilean moons. You have Io, you have Europa, Callisto, and Ganymede. And this one will eventually go into orbit around Ganymede. We're looking at 2031, 2032, something like that. So, almost 10 years from now. Long way to wait to see how JUICE works out. Any comments? WS2N.
AC2 SDP, yeah.
Okay, another question. Say that again, please. It was a little low on my radio.
Okay, good evening. KB2AGP has it gone. We're down here to call Florida.
Okay, John, very good. I have KB2ABP, but it's probably wrong. I have Alpha Bravo Papa. But Florida, very good. Thanks for listening. If you have any comments, we're just filling in for Dr. Roy, who's away for a couple of weeks. back to you, John.
Yes, Roger, since you were on the topic of space, I saw something on the world news tonight. The only problem is I didn't know where it came from. I'm going to say the moon, but that may be wrong. It may have come from Mars. Is the Mars moon that touched down today? On person, on man. Supposedly vacuumed up from debris or rocks or samples of dirt, and they're going to analyze it. They didn't open it up. They took it, I guess it's a secure warehouse. I guess they want to check to make sure it has any radiation or whatever. But they said they were going to open it up tomorrow, examine the contents. Have you heard about that?
Okay, John. Yeah, we started off tonight. This net spot's at 8 o'clock, so, you know, yeah, that was the first topic, because, like you said, it's on the news. So, yeah, I had a bunch of topics, and once I found out, that's got to be the main topic. You know, we've talked about that mission quite a bit on this net over the years. Anyway, to repeat, it was launched in 2016. The name of the spacecraft is called OSIRIS-REx. It went out to an asteroid, Bennu, B-E-N-N-U. It took 2 years to get there, another 2 years in orbit around this thing, investigating issues and all. And then eventually it went down with this arm, the 7-foot arm, and at the end it had something called a TAG unit. TAG stood for Touch and Go, T-A-G. Anyway, when it got near the surface of this thing back in 2020, 2021, something like that, it had a canister of nitrogen on it. Nitrogen shot through the tag arm, and some of the rubble got pushed up inside the tag unit. Tag unit, it's this robotic arm, put it inside of this descent capsule, and it closed, sealed, and amazing that they could do all this stuff. I mean, seal tight as a drum. And this thing is about, the thing that returned to Earth that you saw is about almost 3 feet in diameter, a little shorter. It came back to Earth. Took 2 years to get back to Earth from this asteroid, Bennu. And then went flying through the atmosphere, 27,000 miles an hour, hit it up to 5,000 degrees, and it was over San Francisco when it first came through the atmosphere. And then by the time it landed in the Utah Proving Grounds, the Army Proving Grounds in northeastern Utah. And there it landed. There was parachute and everything. I'm dropping. And then the helicopters came in. They investigated, make sure, you know, there's no fumes or anything. And a helicopter picked it up. They brought it back to a nearby facility, and they'll clean it up a little bit. They're not going to open it. They're going to wait until it gets to Houston. They're going to take a C-17 cargo plane, put it on that, and then they're going to fly that to Houston, and there they'll bring it into a lab. All kinds of nitrogen there, and they're going to make sure whatever goes near this thing is not going to be contaminated. They want to make sure that everything stays pure. So it came from an asteroid, and the asteroid is supposed to be like over 4.5 billion years old. So it's the oldest piece of anything that we've ever investigated. Anyway, John, back to you. This is WS2S. Name is Paul.
Okay, thank you, Paul. That was pretty interesting. Yeah, in fact, I caught the tail end of it, and it did have a little problem. Yeah, so it looks like 10 minutes. But it did determine, and this is not the story, so that's interesting, most of the time it's always about antennas or dipoles or one of the science instruments in the attic or whatever. That's just what I'm thinking about. Trying to get the best possible signal out there or connections around the world. So anyway, very good. Okay, appreciate that. You really summed up really good. Like I said, I know, okay, I wouldn't know it was from meteor, but that's pretty neat that they're able to catch up with something in space and shot this thing, rendezvous with it and bomb out and stuck up like a vacuum cleaner. And I hope that they follow up and say what they found. You know, normally the time they take a big story on the news, and then it just, you know, gets washed away with everything else by the wayside, and then you never really find out what was in the, what was the sample? What came out of it? Is there some type of watering or whatever, you know, sort of like you're looking for life on another planet, sort of thing. But anyway, I hope we've met up too much already. Appreciate it. We'll be on the site. Thank you for picking me up. King Bravo 2, I'll put out Papa, who will be listening in.
Very good. KB2ABPWS1. Well, if I hear anything of what this thing is made out of, I'm sure we'll get some kind of results. I'll definitely talk about it on the net here. You know, this is the TechNet, and Dr. Roy, ACPGS, usually comes on every Sunday at this time, at 8 o'clock, and he'll, you know, he goes through a lot of technical questions, which is great. And he's able to answer quite a few of them. But toward the end of the net, then he leaves the space open for the SpaceNet report, which is what I do. So, you know, it's not this long, you know, usually, you know, half hour and that's it. But we're eating up a little time here until Roy gets back to the net next week. So that's what's going on there. And as far as them looking at stuff, you know, yeah, they did that with Apollo too. You know, 800 pounds of stuff collectively came back from the Apollo missions, the six missions that actually landed on the moon. Total of 840 pounds, I think it was, collectively. So they've been investigating that stuff, you know, for decades. Scientists got a hold of it, and many went around to different countries. There's stories of some of the stuff getting lost and everything, but they kept a portion of it, of the 840 pounds, locked in a lab somewhere. And they said, we're not going to open this up for 50 years. Because, you know, now that you got to remember, last missions were, what, 1972. It was the last Apollo 17 mission in December. So they said, we're going to lock some of this stuff up for 50 years. So that's what they did. So beginning of last year, which was 50 years, since the stuff was locked up, they unlocked it and they're giving it to some scientists. Here we are 50 years later looking at it. The idea was back in 1972, they said, well, we're going to save this stuff because maybe 50 years from now, there's going to be all kinds of equipment and different ways of analyzing these rocks and, you know, the stuff that Apollo brought back. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to save some and the equipment that they're going to have years from now is going to be fabulous. That's what they're going to do with this. Even so, it's only, they said, 5.5, roughly 5.5. Let me think now. It was a little over half a pound of stuff they think is inside this canister. So they're going to save some of it, a little bit of it, and again, they're going to save it for, I don't know yet, but maybe decades to come where 50 years from now, some scientist that's not even born yet, maybe will be poking around with stuff from the OSIRIS-REx mission, you know, and maybe make a discovery that can't be done today. So a good question about you know, looking to see what's in this stuff. If we hear it, if I hear anything, I tend to be on the net every week. I'll definitely talk about it. This is WS2N. Any other comments?
No, you really summed it up. I'll tune in next week. Hopefully we'll hear something over the week about, you know, what they found or what you know, what exactly the kind of content they brought back. And pretty interesting. I also wonder about, you know, the astronauts fighting with all these unmanned rocketeers and stuff there. I really would like to know anything on that. Very intriguing to know that we're only book at all.
Real fine. Okay, very good. Yeah, I always hope that someday they're going to say they found a molecule somewhere on Mars, or maybe one day in the future they'll figure out how to get into the subsurface of one of these icy moons on going around Jupiter. They know there's water under those. Some of those icy moons, but I think that's many decades away before they figure out how to do that. They'd have to get through like 10 miles of ice or something to get to the water underneath. And they say on, for instance, Ganymede or even Europa, there's so much water on it. It's more water in the inside of that moon than there on all of Earth. Sounds kind of hard to believe, but I've heard that many, many times. And they figure, well, if there's water up there, and there's some kind of heat that's going on, chemicals that could react. Maybe there's some kind of life that gets started up there. I don't know. We'll see. I think we got a better chance of maybe receiving a signal from space with our radio antennas. I think we got a better chance at that. That could happen any day. I think I got a long way before they could drill a hole into the moon of Europa or Ganymede. Anyway, let me go on to another topic, and unless somebody else has a comment.
WB2BX out here. I tuned away for a minute. I think you're talking about the discovery of the detection of carbon dioxide being released from Europa.
That's on my list. I wonder if that they use the James Webb Space Telescope. I think you're about to tell me, Frank, right? To look at the moon, and they figured that there's carbon dioxide in on the surface, and they think that some kind of underwater activity or some kind of motions, I don't know what could have created like a slush type of thing where this liquid eventually got up to the surface, and it's detecting the carbon dioxide. And they're hoping that, that's a sign that, if there's carbon dioxide up there, what's breathing it out? And they know now it came from, I'm sure you read the same thing, Frank, but they know now it came from the interior of the moon, Europa. At one point they thought, well, maybe it's being hit by asteroids or something. But now that they know that carbon dioxide is also coming from the interior. So that's hopeful anyway. Back to you, Frank.
I picked this up from Fraser Kane on Universe Today Space Bites. Probably in any number of places. Anyway, he jokingly said maybe it's exhalation from space whale. Of course, it's probably an inorganic source. Made me think of the Douglas Adams novel Goodbye and Thanks for All the Fish. Go ahead.
Yeah. What else could cause oxide? Well, I have to only wait and see. Like I said, juice is going out there, and that's going to go into orbit around Jupiter. We have Juno going around right now, and it doesn't get that close to Europa. No. But maybe choose the one from the European Space Agency. But it's a long wait. You know, I think it's 10. It's probably almost 10 years away, probably 9 years away before they actually get into orbit around Ganymede. But they do plan on passing Europa. We do have another mission coming up, Europa Clipper. And that's a NASA mission. So hopefully that one will do it. It's going to have 43 close passes of Europa. You know, it's going to be orbiting Jupiter. So every now and then it's going to get close to Europa. And each time it's going to get closer and closer. And Europa Clipper has this very thick vault to protect all the electronics, made of titanium, like over an inch thick of material, to protect it from the radiation that Jupiter throws off. So hopefully, maybe we'll find out from Europa Clipper, Frank.
Yeah, well, in terms of life, whatever we do find out there, I'm sure is going to be a surprise, because everything else has been, and probably what the researchers find in the regolith from Bennu is probably going to be a surprise also, like just about everything we seem to find. Go ahead.
Yeah, like I said earlier, even the surface of Bennu, they had, you know, long-range telescopes and they figured out, oh, this thing is flat as a, you know, flat as a pancake. You know, it was diamond shaped. They knew that, but they thought it was going to be, you know, pretty flush. Meanwhile, the thing was rocky as anything. It had, like, you know, like high hills, and they had to be careful with OSIRIS-REx when it went down to the surface to get the stuff off the surface. I remember all that a couple of years ago, and the solar wings would bend back, you know, like a big B, you know, like the wings would bend back as the thing went in close to the surface, so the solar arrays wouldn't hit anything. But they didn't know that, you know, they thought it was flat. Yeah, nothing but a million pebbles and rocks all over. So what are they going to find when they put a microscope on this stuff, right?
Well, whatever it is, it won't be what we expect.
Yeah, I concur. They were there. I don't know. They had alpha neutron spectrometer on board. So they must know what some of the material looked like. They poked around for 2 years before they actually took the sample off the surface. And I wonder if it's going to match what they detected on the surface. Or are they going to find something different in that canister?
Oh, I guess they might find something different than what their instrumentation, what this spectrometry, which I think is something Roy knows a lot about, so we'll have to talk about this again next week. But if they find something different than their instruments suggested, they're going to probably want to rethink the instrumentation or its calibration. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I knew Roy was going to miss tonight's net, which I knew the landing was today. And he followed this thing pretty good. I mean, he was really up on OSIRIS-REx as well as Dick. And, you know, it was a good topic. And he would follow this thing pretty good. We're definitely going to bring up OSIRIS-REx again. Again, next week, that's for sure. Anyway, I have a picture of this. Well, you probably see it on the news, but I have a picture of a couple of people standing around Anister in Utah, and, you know, we'll put it on his website if he has. He'll probably do that himself as well. Very good, Frank. Any other comments before we continue on?
Not right now. I'll probably come back a bit later. Just keep moving and grooving. WB2BX.
Yeah, very good. WB2BX out. Very good. WS2N for ID. Yeah, that's what we try to cover a bunch of topics here, and then somebody might say, I know something about that, and then they could let us know. And that's how I started out here with, you know, ham radio. One of the things I found out, people were interested in the space program, you know. I got involved with these nets, and I said, wow, I'm going to learn a lot from this. And that's what happened, I would say, in the early days. I said, that's how I got a lot of information. All the different theories, the orbital mechanics behind everything. It was a real good source of information for the space program, as well, of course, many, many topics, but, you know, I used it for one of my favorite interests was always the space program. So if I'm not working CW, I'm researching, looking for more space topics. Here's another one. The goal is to bring the rocket course down. When you launch a rocket from Earth, of course, they predict like $10 per pound just to you know, maybe send it on to the moon or something. Some ridiculous price just to get it to orbit. It's thousands and thousands of dollars per pound of material. You know, if it's water, it weighs a pound, it costs thousands of dollars to do that. So the idea is to drop the price, and SpaceX has been very good at that, driving the price way down. I remember 10, 15 years ago, you would send a rocket up, a Delta II rocket, something, they would say, oh, it's going to cost $300 million to launch this thing. Whatever satellite we're talking about. SpaceX comes along, and now they've driven that price down to $62 million, roughly, for Falcon 9 launch. Phenomenal. Well, they're not the only ones doing it. The company Rocket Lab launches the Electron rocket, and they've driven the prices down. I think that's something in the $20 million or $15 million category. And they've launched now a little over 40 rockets now. They have three different launch complexes. They have two located on the North Island of New Zealand, and then another one that they've opened up not too far from here in Wallops Island, Virginia. They have their own launch complex out of that as well. Now, you know, they're not fully reusable yet, you know. I mean, they're bringing back, well, Rocket Lab has successfully brought back many, many different boosters. They haven't relaunched any yet. I think they launched one engine as a test. They took one of their nine engines and launched it. But eventually they'll get there. But they'll be doing it too. Anyway, their price is really low anyway. Because of their manufacturing technique, and you know, everybody else is going to follow. Relativity is building a rocket that they plan on competing with SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, also going to be reusable. Rocket Lab is building their own Neutron rocket. Medium lift vehicle, heavier than the Electron rocket. Not as heavy as the Falcon 9, but close. And they plan on making most of that reusable. So here comes a company called Stoke Space, S-T-O-K-E Space. Their goal is to have a fully 100% reusable vehicle. And YouTube on it, plus I've seen I've read quite a bit about their vehicle. In fact, if you go to Stoke Space and, you know, you bring that up, they actually have a video of one of their goals, and their goal is to make the second stage reusable. You know, right now Falcon 9 goes up, Electron goes up, their goals are to reuse the boosters, but the second stage comes a throwaway. You know, they'll ignite the engine again, slow it down in orbit, and then burn it up in the atmosphere. Stoke Space, they haven't launched yet, but they're working on it. They're starting with the second stage first. Their goal is to create the second stage. They have a heat shield on the bottom of the second stage. But instead of having rockets, you know, in the center, you know, one or two or three rockets in the center of the, you know, of the second stage, they have thrust chambers all around the circumference of this rocket. And right now, I saw a test. They ran a test. They launched one of these things from the ground, the second stage vehicle, and it went up. And it went up like 15, 20 feet, and then it moved over. I think it went over 30 feet, up 30 feet, and it flew for 15 seconds, and then came back down and landed. So they're testing this thing out, but it's an interesting design. They have the engines on the circumference of the vehicle, and in the middle is the heat shield. So their goal is once they have a first stage developed, which will work on that, that will also be reusable. That will launch, you know, both vehicles up. First stage will come back and land. They'll reuse that. They're pretty sure they know how to do that, but nobody's been able really to be successful with the second stage. And the second stage is interesting. You know, inside the second stage, they have this one big turbo pump system. You know, any rocket engine needs liquid oxygen and then a liquid fuel. In this case, they're using liquid hydrogen. So they have this pump set up inside the vehicle with a 1,000 horsepower system behind it, spinning the turbos up. So this thing gets launched in space. These rockets, it'll be 30 chambers surrounding the central heat shield. These rocket engines will have to actually fire around four different times. One to put, you know, finish getting the payload to space. Another one to complete that payload to space. And then they usually have to slow down. They have to fire it again, and then it'll re-enter the atmosphere with a heat shield. No parachute. It's going to be propulsive landing. It'll fly through the atmosphere, and these engines will again come on all the way down to landing. So that's the design, and it looks pretty cool. We'll see how it works out. To keep that heat shield cool, you know, they become very hot, and some of them are a blade of, you know, material blows away. This thing's not. It's going to be heat shield. But they call it actively cooling. In other words, these pumps that pump this liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen to the engine are going to have piping and fins and everything, and it's going to be near this heat shield. It's actually going to be actively cooling the heat shield as it comes through the atmosphere. So that's an interesting design. Nobody else has it so far, and I'm going to be interested in, you know, seeing this thing eventually get off the ground. Probably early next year is what they're planning. American company, headquartered up in the state of Washington, and it looks promising. Well, we'll have to see. The fairings, which on most vehicles all the ones that launch today, once it gets up to say 60 miles or high, you know, into space, first thing they do is they get rid of the fairings, and that exposes the payload to space. And because it's a vacuum, they don't have to worry about it could be any shape, that payload will just be fine as it's flying through at 17,500 miles an hour or in orbit. And but the fairings, they always, you know, re-enter the atmosphere. SpaceX, yeah, they're doing pretty good. They come through the atmosphere, it's separate, you know, and they open up with parachutes. Well, they have power gliding system, and eventually they know where it's going to land, and they pick those fairings up with a with their recovery ship, and they reuse the fairings when they can, which is like most of the times now. They got quite good at it. But these fairings on Stoke will be...